Welcome back to the third segment of our four-part beef roundtable discussion on how the change in Washington leadership might impact agriculture and the beef industry in particular. In the second segment, we focused our discussion on the GPSA rules and rulemaking. In this segment, our guests Steve Dittmer and Jay Truitt will focus on the anticipated 2018 Farm Bill. I'm Dr. Ron Lemonager, Beef Extension Specialist at Purdue University.
And I'm Bert Rutherford, Senior Editor of Beef Magazine, based in Denver, Colorado. You know, gentlemen, as we're sitting here having this conversation, Sonny Perdue has not yet been confirmed as Secretary of Agriculture, but I think we can assume that will happen. When it does, what do you see as really the top really pressing issues that Mr. Perdue's going to have to deal with?
Nobody wants to talk about this, but the first Farm Bill hearing are already in place. And so, I mean, we're already going through the mechanics of starting that process. It's going to expire. Obviously, the order from both Congress and or the statutory requirements from Congress and what Mr. Trump has done through holding off the rules, which is a pretty traditional thing that happens at the beginning of every administration in regards to a previous administration, means that there'll be a bunch of unfinished business that'll occupy his time for the first 100 to 120 days that he's in office. They'll review all those rules. They'll have a bunch of requirements and staffing, et cetera. But the reality is it takes about a year to actually write and develop a farm bill in the United States of America. USDA has to do a bunch of homework ahead of time to get ready for that. Clearly, this administration's viewpoint is going to be different from the previous administration, so the policy points that would have already been put on paper, they go out the window. That stuff goes in the trash now, and so they're starting from scratch in many respects. I think he'll be well occupied for the first 9 or 10 months that he's in office, just to get to the point where he can meet Congress's deadlines at the end of this year, which honestly I think we all believe will probably roll in well into next year as well.
One question that comes along this route when you're talking about the Farm Bill has to do with insurance, crop insurance, some of the few that USDA should be perhaps doing, things like that in conservation work, and yet some of our conservative allies are the ones who we're going to have to deal with on that standpoint because they see that as a subsidy that's not really necessary. And I have a feeling that there is no other industry that's involved with something truly uncontrollable any more than agriculture and weather and climate. And I don't mean climate change. We know climate change is going to occur. I don't believe in the man-made part of it at all. But that really does have a huge effect on the success or failure, the elimination sometimes of farm operations. What kind of climate are we going to have to deal with in this Farm Bill when it comes to conservation and especially crop insurance?
Yeah, so if you go backwards in that conversation just a little bit, Steve, I think there's probably as much pressure on the traditional Title I subsidy programs in this Farm Bill as there ever has been. And people just don't want to see a check written that they can't really identify that as something that we do in other industries. Crop insurance is the exception to that, right? And people get it. I insure my car, I insure my house, and the conversation takes place well, but the government subsidizes that. And is that important? But the truth is, the government actually makes flood insurance possible for all of us. Your point that all these specialty crops and including maybe some livestock components will end up in this mix at some point. And at the end of the day, if you're going to pass a farm bill, in the U.S. Congress, you're going to have to quote unquote, I know people hate this term, but you've got to buy those votes. And how are you going to buy them? Well, it's not going to be with a new subsidy program. So it's going to have to be offering services to some of those people that fit outside the normal corn, bean, wheat, cotton, rice model in the past. We've dramatically increased the number of people that are in the crop insurance arena over the last, say, the last two farm bills. Certainly since 2002 has been a big shift. That's a rocket ship, not a slow incline. I think that number will dramatically increase more.
Is that because of the drought that we've seen and the drive to protect risk from the farmers, or have we made it too good a deal? I'm not a row crop expert, so I don't know, but I just know there's a monster consideration that has to go on if you're a corn or wheat farmer as to how you handle risk management that way.
Yeah, no, I think trying to compare the crop insurance products that are in the marketplace today with the crop insurance products that were in the marketplace even just 10 or 12 years ago is like comparing a 1950s show steer to the National Western winner today. They're almost unrecognizable to each other. And it's producers have designed most of the innovations in these products. And everybody wonders, well, how does that apply to the beef industry? Well, you know, we know what we don't want to happen to corn. We also know that corn growers need to make a living, and so there's that balance, and we need to figure out how we actually help them stay within those boundaries. But no, I think it's true. I think it's all driven by innovation in crop insurance products, and actually how they can sell them, and the reality is a lot of those premiums really are dramatically less just because the products are better.
Well, the two of you have kind of brought up the farm bill, okay, and that's to be finalized in 2018. The main sections of the farm bill deal with commerce, labor, and entitlements. What do we have to look forward to, or in some cases maybe dread, in the new farm bill?
We're going to spend less money overall. That number is going to be smaller. I think we will have a debate, probably a pretty extensive debate, about moving food nutrition programs and that whole arena over into block grants that go out to states, et cetera. It's no secret Paul Ryan loves that kind of stuff. He's advocated for it in the past. I don't think he'll be successful at the end of the day. There's just really not the votes to make that kind of a transition. But the whole reason that you would is that when you don't save that money in that particular area, you're going to have to save it somewhere else. And outside of conservation programs and SNAP programs, everything else is heads on the chopping block. And I would say both those programs certainly could get a really close manicure when it's all said and done. We're going to spend less money. That's just almost a certainty, or at least we're going to anticipate spending lots of money, depending on how we structure the programs.
What about the age-old question? Do we 70 to 80% of the farm bill has nothing to do with farming? It's all the nutrition and attenuated programs, and some say we have to keep them attached if we're going to get anything for agriculture. Others say, we get, I was in a discussion with a pretty intelligent person the other day who was shocked to find out that most of the USDA budget has nothing to do with farming or ranching. That's still out there. There's a lot of people on both sides of that fence. Jay is a longtime observer. What do you think? Separate them or not? We keep
So typically when we have this conversation, we talk about it from the perspective that we need those urban voters to help us pass whatever we want to do involved in agriculture. I've had a whole series of conversations with people from urban regions that really were only interested in the food nutrition component. And I will tell you that they're almost as concerned about the split potentially happening, because they need all those rural votes to actually help them. And it is on the basis that they believe that if we do nutrition programs all by themselves and we just have that out on the floor for a couple of weeks, that that becomes a vehicle for people to start doing a bunch of social and morality type votes on top of a food nutrition program vote. And that spirals downward pretty quickly, I think, in most people's minds, and becomes a real quagmire of whether or not you're connecting too many things, whether it's drug testing for eligibility. And again, you can just imagine, and I think some of them are concerned that that becomes a vehicle for Planned Parenthood votes and all those things that are really ugly and have nothing to do with us and typically don't really come up during a farm bill debate, that it would open that door. I see the two being more closely tied together, just because there are a lot of components inside of the food nutrition service that do involve us. We screwed up a lot of stuff in the last administration over whether it be potatoes or meat exemptions in school lunches, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We should make sure that somewhere within this whole framework, that everybody stays on the same page about what we're going to do from an expenditure standpoint. But we got to be honest with ourselves here when we look around, and it's one of the things that I talk to people about when they say, well, how do I actually get Congress to listen to me, et cetera? Well, even when I started lobbying as a younger guy, there were 30 or 40 members of Congress that had been a farmer or a rancher in their life, or they had spent a significant amount of time doing that. You could have a real fact-based, practical experience kind of conversation with those people. I think you can count the number of people that have had that same experience today on one hand, and really in about three fingers, when you get down to a lot of them claim to have been farmers, but the truth is, how many of them really drove a combine or spent some time on horseback or vaccinated a calf any time in the last 12 months, and it becomes this really small number. So, I mean, if that's going to be the case and that's going to be your audience that you're talking to, and it's going to be people, you'd better have something positive to bring to that table, or it's not going to fare well for you.
Well, I think you bring up a very important point that hadn't occurred to me before. Is we keep these things together, that gives us license to get into some of the nutrition and help. Dietary Goals Advisory Committee alone in setting the dietary guidelines has a huge impact, and it has on the beef industry from the 1970s on. And now, with the amount of new research we're getting to show that A, not only was some of the previous recent recommendations wrong, but the research was probably purposely loaded that way. Somewhat similar, I guess, to the way some of the climate change stuff has been fudged and fiddled with. And that's had a huge impact on animal products of every sort for 50 years. And so being having that stuff under the purview of USDA, even though the dietary guidelines themselves are put together by both USDA and HHS, I can't imagine what kind of guidelines we would have been living under the last 20 years if we hadn't had USDA and some idea of what it takes to produce food, what healthy food, wholesome food is all about, much less the nutritional theories. I wonder if the meat industry would have, and even the poultry industry would have been in terrible shape.
I'll give you a good example of where it has been separated out is in the WIC program, which has already been separated out. That's the next biggest nutrition program that the U.S. is involved in. that program, because it's not tied to the Farm Bill and it's not attached to these other programs, it's actually, its jurisdiction is over in the Health Committee in the House. Well, the difference between that, the last time that we went through and we did all these, when Democrats were actually running things on Capitol Hill, was the difference between dealing with Henry Waxman or Colin Peterson. Well, anybody involved in agriculture that wouldn't prefer to work with Colin Peterson over Henry Waxman or his heir on that committee just doesn't understand, you know, the reality of how much that can change what really happens to you at a production level. And so if you take SNAP away, it sounds like an easy thing to do, but how have you empowered anybody at USDA to work with you more closely? You just took most of their staff and potentially move them over to another agency even, because the very immediate next conversation is that, well, maybe they'd fit better over at FDA. And that's not in the beef industry's best interest, in my opinion. And I honestly don't think it's in the best interest of the people that actually use those programs as well. USDA has almost an exclusive role in government of being one of those agencies that's very service-oriented. They may not always do a good job, and we can criticize them about it, but they don't wake up every day and think about, as a general rule, how can we punish somebody for not doing what we said, or how can we charge somebody to actually provide a fee-for-service activity. They typically say, we're supposed to be serving a segment of the community or the economy, and we need to actually do that. Those are big changes in mindset. If you go to FDA, the first people that you meet when you walk in the door are the enforcement team, not actually the communications team. There's a big difference in the way, just the way that all shakes together. I think it would be a disaster for us to separate the programs out. It might make it easier or harder for us, and for people like me, heck, I'll make a lot of money because I'll get to lobby two bills instead of one. If you think that's good, America, then go ahead, support that idea. My bank account will appreciate it, but it's a bad idea for you.
I agree.
That wraps up our third segment discussion on the 2018 Farm Bill and how it's going to impact animal agriculture. Please join us next time when our guests, Steve and Jay, will discuss immigration reform and how that's going to impact us at the ranch gate.